Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Literary Viewpoints, MJ Network. This is Fran Lewis. And we have an author today that's going to really mystify you, because those of you that are into signs and astrology, this book is A+ for you. You're going to learn so much more about how to tell your signs and whatever, and as long as Julia doesn't read mine and tell me anything bad, I'm good. I'll be just fine. So the title of the book is All Signs Point to Murder. You figure that out. And we've got the author, Connie DeMarco, here. And good morning. Are you ready? This is going to be so much fun.
I am, Fran. It's great to chat with you.
Well, Julia is your star. I met her.
Mm-hmm.
Julia is an astrologer, a.k.a. detectives in some respects. So how and why did you decide to make her an astrologer? Because I found that really interesting, because that's different.
Well, the thing about Julia is that I wanted a protagonist with an unusual occupation. And more importantly, Julia, because of her profession, deals with all kinds of people from all walks of life. So she could have a client who's a businessman or a client who's a teenager. And, of course, you know, they present their problems to her, and she's pulled into their lives and their and the investigation, and ultimately she always unmasks a murderer.
Well, I wish it were that easy in real life to unmask. But
yeah.
let me give some people a little summary, which is on my screen. Rob Raymer was the perfect husband until he committed the ultimate faux pas. He shot his sister-in-law to death. Maybe he didn't like her. Believing himself under attack by an intruder in his home, he fired back. When evidence discovered that Rob's wife, Brooke, was, well, we'll find out what she wanted to do, Brooke is charged with conspiracy in her sister's death. Nobody kills their sister, really. Geneva, a third sister, is desperate for answers, and who does she ask for help? San Francisco astrologer Julia Bonanni. Julia's lost one sister, and now she seems that she's going to lose another. Was this a murder plot or an accident? I'm not going to tell you. It's all in the stars. So what does Julia mean when she says she has to create the charts for each of these people in order to proceed to have to solve the problem, solve the murder?
Well, Julia sets up charts. She has her friend's chart, and she wants to set up the charts for the rest of the family in this particular mystery. Geneva, her good friend, doesn't have all the information because, of course, we have to get to towards the end of the book before Julia can actually, she's gone through her investigation and she can actually figure out who probably did this murder. What I try to do is set up accurate charts, accurate birth charts for the main people that I talk about in the book. For example, I don't think I'm giving away anything here, but Geneva's sister who is killed, Julia looks at her chart and realizes that her so-called boyfriend couldn't possibly be her boyfriend, because she knows from the transits to this woman's birth chart that she's involved in a very heavy, intense affair with someone. And Julia spends some time trying to figure out who this person is, because nobody, it was secret, and nobody in the woman's family knew who she was having the affair with.
Well, that is always so cool. And that is different. So who is Cheryl? And she calls Julia to fill in for her at work. So what is Julia going to do for her? Well, she's panicking and she needs her help right away.
Well, Julia's good friend Gail owns a shop called the Mystic Eye Bookshop. It's an occult shop. They sell books, they sell gifts, and they do psychic fairs. And Julia every once in a while gets roped into doing a psychic fair, which is they will have psychics, astrologers, past life, hypnotists, all sorts of things, and customers come in and they pay $10 for 10 minutes. It's just kind of a way that her good friend Gail generates business for the shop. Julia doesn't work there. Cheryl is their other friend who works in the shop. She manages the Mystic Eye. And Julia just happened to be there, and Cheryl needed a little help, and Julia didn't mind. So, because these are her good friends, and this is one of the main settings in these mysteries is the Mystic Eye Bookshop, where Julia, even though she's not a psychic, but she rubs shoulders with psychics and various people who have an occult profession.
That's interesting. So how accurate are these psychics, really?
I've, in my life, in real life, run into a few that are amazing. I met a woman many, many years ago who claimed that she communicated with your own spirit guides in a reading. And she wasn't the kind of psychic who would say, oh, you're going to meet a tall, dark, handsome stranger. It was nothing like that. It was as if she had kind of a bird's eye view of your life and your life path and your desires and where you were heading and what you were creating in your life. And she used to say that when she read for very creative people, she could actually see their life path changing and morphing as she talked to them. Because I believe, and I think she probably did too, that we literally create our experiences.
That's interesting. I wonder if it's just how scary it is when the psychic looks at you and says, oh, I don't know if you want to know this. that would scare me.
Well, hopefully they'll edit.
Yeah, hopefully they won't tell you that, oh, my God, this is going to happen or that's going to happen. So tell us about Geneva and David's wedding and what happens that sort of puts a damper on it. This poor girl can't win.
Okay, I have to be careful not to give away any spoilers, Fran.
Right, exactly.
Julia has been asked to be a bridesmaid at her friend Geneva's wedding. She and Geneva go way back. They shared an apartment when they were in college, and Geneva's life has become quite settled. She's getting married. Julia, on the other hand, had a fiancé. She was engaged, and her fiancé had been killed in a hit-and-run accident. So Julia spends a lot of time avoiding baby showers, weddings. The thing is that Geneva was a very, very close friend, and Geneva was there for Julia when Julia was going through such a hard time. So Julia can't say no to Geneva, so she agrees to be a bridesmaid. She wishes that she had been asked to choose the date for the wedding because she doesn't really like the current transits that are lining up for the marriage chart. The wedding goes off almost without a hitch. The only thing that happens is that one of Geneva's other sisters, Moira, goes AWOL just before the ceremony. And so that sort of puts a damper on things and a little bit of confusion. And later she's found and she's been fighting with her boyfriend. And that's kind of the setup from the very beginning. The action takes place sort of after the wedding, the really dramatic action. The wedding is sort of a tense opening scene. But then, of course, Moira's shot.
I know. That was so sad. And, yeah, so who is the wedding planner? What happens to her, Sally Starr?
Well,
I felt so bad for her.
She was a minor character, really. She's the organizer for the inn where the wedding takes place, and she's getting very, very annoyed with the Leary family, Geneva and her sisters, and especially the sister that disappeared. She collapses during the wedding, and she kind of adds what happens to her sort of adds to the general air of tension as to what is going on at this wedding, because nothing seems to be going quite right. And Julia isn't surprised because, you know, there's a Mars and Pluto lineup in the heavens, and she was kind of expecting that there would be a number of problems at this wedding.
That's so sad to predict. She's sort of like a psychic in her own way, yeah. So there are several characters. I crossed out some because we don't want to give away too much. Why didn't anybody like Sally? She's the wedding planner. Actually, at my brother-in-law's wedding, I wasn't crazy about the wedding planner either. So, yeah.
You
never
can
know.
Relate.
Some of these wedding planners, they're overbearing, and at times it has to be done this way and that way, and like, excuse me, I don't think so. So we have Sally, and tell us about Brooke and Rob. Those, they're interesting characters, let me tell you. Well, how come nobody likes Sally? Well, maybe it's because she's too annoying. Who knows?
Well, she's wound very tight, Sally, and she's trying to run a very, very tight ship. And, of course, when things don't go her way or go as planned, she, I think, threatens Brooke in the beginning, where she says, you will never, ever plan another event here. And Brooke manages not to lose her temper. There are three sisters, Geneva, who is Julia's close friend, her older sister, Brooke, who's very fashionable and very accomplished, and she's the editor of a fashion magazine in the city, and Moira, who's the third sister, who's kind of, she's the baby of the family, and she's kind of the ne'er-do-well sister. She never quite found her own way, and she has a drinking problem. She had developed a drug problem. The three sisters also have a brother. There's four children in all, and the brothers, they all love Moira, and they all try to do their best for her, and they're just hoping that she straightens out and has some kind of a decent life for herself. She's still floundering, poor Moira, and we learn more about her towards the end as to why she's killed.
Well, we're not going to tell anybody that, because
no,
we have
can't.
To read the book to find out. Besides, Julia will predict some bad stars for you if you dare to ask. That's all I'll say about that, yeah. So we got Brooke and Andy and Dan. And what role does Andy and Dan play? I mean, at least the family doesn't seem to get along, though, from what I gathered, but I remember.
Well, the family gets along. They're kind of a very typical Irish family who have lived in San Francisco for generations. Dan Leary. He is the brother to Geneva and Brooke and Moira. And they are a very close family, and they're very close with their mother, Mary. Andy is a friend of the brother, Dan, and Andy has been dating Moira. But Andy and Moira have been fighting a lot, and actually they get into an argument at the dinner at the wedding, and Moira storms off. And everybody's kind of covering for all this tension between the young couple, and trying to ignore it and hoping they get through the wedding without another hitch, you know, because you know how stressful those events can be. It depends kind of on the people involved, but it's always stressful because everybody wants everything to turn out just perfectly, and they want to get through the day. And, of course, they're very protective of Geneva as well, and Geneva's really a sweetheart, and she's marrying a very decent guy, David. And, you know, it's I hope it's not confusing all the various characters at the wedding, at the opening scene, but I do think they become clearer as the book goes on.
No, it was clear. I got it. Don't ever worry.
Good.
If I got it, they'll look. So,
okay.
This happens. Yeah, and Julia decides to spend the night at Brooke's home. But you know, you could felt. I felt that I was being forewarned. All right, Julia's there. This can't be good. Something's going to happen. What makes Julia realize that something is wrong? It's like a red flag goes up, and she hears something. So what makes her realize that something isn't right? She sort of braved it, let me tell you.
She hears gunshots in the night.
Yeah.
And that wakes her up. And up until then, everything's fairly smooth. Moira has been acting strange. Her brother's kind of ignoring her because he thinks she's a drama queen. But everybody calls it a day and goes to bed in the great big house that Brooke and Rob live in, and it's gunshots in the wee hours that wake Julia up.
It's amazing that she heard that. It's amazing that she went to find out. So what happens when they find who is killed? What do they do?
They all gather, and the police are called, and I don't want to say too much about Rob and his reaction to the whole thing. But that's the beginning of the mystery.
we won't tell anybody about too much about any of them. So
right.
Why do they, I mean, this poor guy, David, he gets married, but why do they think he's the one that's the killer? Why, tell us why David is also a suspect and why Brooke, Geneva, Gail, Mary, and their mother are so shaken up by this. I feel so bad for her.
I feel bad for the mother, too. Mary's lost her youngest child,
yeah.
And she's just completely devastated.
Yeah.
Brooke and Geneva and Dan have lost their sister. Dan never particularly liked Brooke's husband, but he kept his mouth shut for the sake of peace in the family. The family assumes that it must have been someone outside the house, outside the family. The police, of course, are going to consider everybody in the house as a potential suspect. But Geneva and her new husband, David, were planning on going on their honeymoon, and they parked their car inside Brooke and Rob's garage for safekeeping, and David had a gun, and he locked it up in the trunk because their house, they were having some construction at their house. He didn't want their car and particularly the gun in the house. He wanted it put somewhere for safekeeping. And he later discovers that the gun is missing. Someone has taken it from the trunk of his car. And it could have been anybody in the wedding party because people were sort of in and out of that house preparing for the wedding and the wedding rehearsal. And he's panicked, absolutely panicked. And Geneva is panicked, his wife. And Julia doesn't really suspect David, but she does wonder who could have possibly taken the gun from his car.
This is a very good way to start off being married, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah, isn't that great? They
isn't
should have asked
great?
An astrologer
yeah, okay.
for
so
the
we
wedding
got married
date.
And they'll never forget that on my anniversary we're going to celebrate that somebody got shot at my wedding. I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
As we get to know Moira, and what do we learn about Moira that comes up that our family didn't know? And then they started to suspect Andy. A lot of people get suspected of this murder before the real person is revealed. We won't say who. So what about her didn't they know?
Well, they knew that Moira hadn't really found her way in life, that she had addiction problems. They all loved her. They all supported her. They hoped she was staying straight. And her brother mentions at one point that she was going to AA even though she wasn't totally sober and not drinking. And they knew she was dating Andy. They didn't know or weren't aware of some of the dealings that Andy was involved in and may have also involved Moira. And they also didn't know that she had a secret lover. And, of course, that's the thing that sends up a red flare for Julia when she looks at Moira's chart and realizes that Pluto is transiting the ruler of her fifth house, and I won't bore you with astrology, but she knows that Moira had to have been involved in something very intense.
It's too bad Moira didn't live long enough to tell us more about it. Then we
right.
everybody out of their poor misery to not know. So
right, but then we wouldn't
character.
Have a mystery.
I know. So sad. And then Julie wouldn't have anything to solve, and that would be worse. So
right.
Who is Matt, and what about him and Brooke? Oh, these people are really naughty, let me tell you. I don't know.
Well, we had to
mix
it up a bit.
This family has an awful lot of fun.
Well, Matt is a good friend of the groom, David. Matt is a stockbroker in the city, and he met the Leary family through David. Through David, he met Geneva, and he met her sisters, and he met Brooke. And he had an intense attraction for Brooke at a time when Brooke and Rob were fighting quite a bit and looking perhaps at a divorce if they couldn't work things out. And Matt meets Julia, my protagonist, at the wedding. They're all in the wedding party. And Julia he asks Julia what she does, and she doesn't particularly want to tell him because he looks like kind of a straight, business-oriented guy, and she figures he might laugh at her profession. And she finally, he keeps prodding her, and finally she says, I do personal consultations. Oh, really? What sort of personal consultations? And Julia says, I'm an astrologer. And he's very interested. He wants to become her client. And later along in the story, he does call her and comes for a reading.
Yeah, I know. And that gets interesting. And that's all we'll say about that. So
right.
When Julia goes to Moira's apartment, because Geneva asks her to go through the apartment, she's attacked. So what does she do? Does she report it? If not, why not? Why does she keep it to herself?
She tells Geneva eventually what happened.
Yeah.
She can't go to the police about it because, first of all, she has no business being there. I mean, she has a legal right to be there because Moira's sister has given her a key, but she also knows that she's really snooping around in what is an official police investigation, so she really doesn't dare tell the police. She's also freaked and panicked because whoever attacked her stole Moira's notebook, telephone book, that might have given the police and the family some clues as to what was really going on in Moira's life. So even though she knows that she was probably attacked by the murderer, and the murderer also knows where Julia lives, if he doesn't or she doesn't already, she really can't report this. So she does find one item in Moira's apartment that is a big clue that leads to a jewelry shop downtown, but the notebook is gone and pretty much any other clue to Moira's life is gone.
Well, when we finally meet the detective in charge, the person, they don't want her snooping around. How come? They get annoyed.
He gets annoyed? Oh, sure, because I think any real detective cop would certainly be annoyed when a civilian is sticking their nose into an investigation. And, of course, he's there. He shows up at Julia's apartment one day, and she's feeling very guilty about her activities, and he questions her, and, of course, she's quite nosy, and she starts to question him, but he doesn't give away any information at all.
Well, he's not going to. That would be, you know. But somehow she has a way of worming her way into things anyway. So,
yeah, she's an amateur.
She doesn't want to do this. Yeah, I know. So why does Geneva insist that she solve the case and she doesn't trust the police? And yet, doesn't this put her in a dangerous position? She could actually be arrested if she gets too involved, or she could get hurt.
Well, Geneva's big fear is that when the police investigate Moira's life, they'll kind of write her off as a drug-addled, you know, loser. And the family loves Moira, and they don't want the police coming to that conclusion. They want this investigated very thoroughly to find out who killed their sister. And Geneva doesn't ask Julia really to solve the case. She just asks Julia to go to Moira's apartment and look around for anything that might give them a clue as to what was going on in Moira's life. She doesn't ask Julia to take anything with her. She leaves it up to Julia's discretion. And Julia, I don't know if Julia would have taken the notebook had she not been attacked, she does take the jewelry item that she finds in a drawer next to the bed to show it to Geneva because she thinks that perhaps it might belong to their other sister, Brooke. And as it turns out, it didn't, of course.
So why do they arrest Brooke after a while, don't they? I mean, they seem to be arresting a whole lot of people. So why do they arrest...
Well, they question David... And, of course, a neighbor saw David, so that sends them in David's direction. But I don't want to say too much about why they arrest Brooke.
No.
But the police do find evidence of communications between Brooke and Moira, and they start worrying about a conspiracy plot. And, of course, this would be terribly serious because in California there's the felony murder rule. And it may exist in other states, but if someone is killed in the commission of even a minor crime, it could be life imprisonment. For example, a robbery may take place, but if an innocent bystander gets shot in the meantime, it wouldn't be a charge of just robbery to the perpetrator. It would be a charge of murder, and that rule would come into place. And since Moira, if there was a conspiracy and Moira died as a result of that conspiracy, that would be terribly serious. Yeah.
It's terribly serious anyway. I don't think enough people know that, though. And
yeah.
Julia was really kind of brave to get involved, because if somebody gets hurt and she's there, she could have a problem too. I mean, she can get in trouble also. But then that would kill the story.
Well, sure, I'm sure the police would frown on Julia's activities, but she really doesn't intend to get into trouble. She really just wants to go around, talk to everyone that's involved, and try to find out what was going on in Moira's life, and at least convey that to the family and to the police if she does find anything. She never in a million years thinks that she'll come up against what she comes up against towards the end of the book.
That is true. Well, then she goes to Mako, and that was not smart either. Why did she do that? I mean,
well,
she was sending her all over the place. That's scary.
Yeah. She goes to the bar Macau down in the Embarcadero because she wants to find Tony, who's a bartender there, who was a good friend of Moira's, or at least a work friend of Moira's. And that's the only reason she goes there. What she discovers there is opens up a whole other range of possibilities as to what is going on at this bar behind the scenes, and she really hopes against hope that Moira wasn't involved in any of that. There's an implication of human trafficking and certainly drug trafficking, and Julia doesn't mean to stumble upon what she stumbles upon, but she does, and she manages to get out of there without being spotted, which was no small feat given the circumstances. So like most amateur sleuths, she has to stick her nose out there and take a chance and get herself into lots of trouble. And that's another thing, too, is I always there's a Raymond Chandler book called Trouble Is My Business, I believe. If I read it, I read it years ago. And I always try to remember that when I'm writing, because you really don't want your protagonist's path to be easy. You have to create obstacles and create difficulties and create dangers, because I think that's really the reason that people turn pages.
Well, if there's no obstacles and it's too easy, you get bored.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I have read, I've lost count of how many murder mysteries I have read in the last week. Seriously. I read quite a few this week. And I've read quite a few that are very enlightening on certain issues that I'll say after when I, you know, list my favorite books for the week, I think. Yes, I think I started on with Saturday, and I read 5 already, maybe 6, and I started like 3 more. Yeah, I read fast. My mother made me read 10 books a week and take notes besides doing 20 hours of homework and everything else. So I take notes when I read. So if you ever saw your book, you would not recognize it, because in order for me to be perfect and ask the right questions and do a perfect review, I have to circle, underline, write, use, and then I remember it anyway, which
it's
is pretty
hard.
Good.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah,
I read fast, too, and when I get through a book, I remember it, or really, but certain parts of it will stay with you more than others, don't you think?
Yeah, they do, certain parts. In certain books, you know, Simon Cowell is on, with American Idol, he's on America's Got Talent. He's mellow just a little, but he used to say when a singer came up or an act came up that they were forgettable. And that makes it hard, because most books that I read are not forgettable, but the one or two that are forgettable, you forget what they're about, and it makes it hard. And if a police officer finds it too easy to solve a case, or there's no obstacles to solve it, or nothing in the way, then you begin to wonder, that's not a mystery, that's just telling a story, and that's not
right.
fun at all.
Right. It's I don't know if you're a fan of Michael Connelly's, but when you read Harry Bosch book, Harry has one problem after another, and then he has problems within his own department. And it's, I think, one of the best police procedural types of books that I've ever read, because he puts in a lot of detail, but it's not boring. It never gets boring.
Well, speaking of police procedural, I'm glad you said that. On November 9th, the one and only, probably the best person that can do police procedural, D.P. Lyle, will be on my show.
He writes for Criminal Minds.
Yeah. Not bad, right? FBI agent Michael Tabman, lawyer Larry Thompson, and criminal detective Bruce Coffin will all be on my show to talk about how to present a case in a book. How do you relate forensics? How he's going to do forensics? How do you present the case to the police? What happens when the FBI takes over? And how do you present it in court? Because I've read so many that are so wrong. It's scary.
Mm-hmm.
So
DP,
he's definitely, and his new book, A-List, is hilarious. It's a murder mystery, but it's funny. And he's coming on December 11th. It gets better, but Julia seems to be unstoppable, and she's not going to get hurt. But at times, she makes bad decisions. So she reminds me of two of my favorite mystery people on television, Jessica Fletcher, and the other one who I love really is Hedy Winthrop, because she sort of solved the murders in a different way with that when the movie's like when she was there. So how did you create her like that? She's more like a combination of a whole bunch of people, maybe even the heart-to-heart character. And it's like my mother made me watch everything. The reruns of everything she wants. If you're gonna know something, don't read Nancy Drew. Watch television and learn. So I mean, even Matlock is he's good, but these guys are better. I mean, and one of the best historical fiction mystery writers in the whole world is Daniel Palmer, and he's phenomenal too. I met him and Robert Dagoni at the Thriller Fest, and I was like in awe. And then when they walk up, they said to me, "Oh my God, it's Fran." I go, "Thank you. At least you remember who I am. That's good."
Oh, Thriller Fest is so much fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm flattered that you're comparing Julia to Hedy Wainthrop and Jessica Fletcher. I loved Hedy Wainthrop, and you know I analyzed it quite a lot because a lot of times she'll send her young sidekick, who later starred in the Hobbit movies, Jess. I want to say Jess. Am I right?
Yeah, I like him.
She would send Jess out to do certain investigations, and usually he got in trouble. And, of course, the husband always stayed home, and then Hedy would investigate. But it was a wonderful kind of a cozy mystery without being overly cloying. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I loved their home and the fact that they took this young guy in, and eventually he finds a girlfriend and he moves out. And it was just a charming, really charming series. I loved it. I wish it were still on the air.
Yeah, me too. I wish they would bring it back. And, of course, I love Patricia Rutledge. I think she's great as Hyacinth. She's so like my mother. And I love as time goes by. I mean, the British comedies are really good, especially the fact that they don't have commercials. It makes it better, but they don't make them today. I mean, Criminal Minds, my husband loves it, and it's great, but sometimes the violence gets to be a little bit too much for young adults and teens to watch. So,
yeah,
you know, I hesitate.
True.
Whereas this book, anybody could read, which makes it better. So I can tell you, young teenagers out there, you could read this because it's very, very straightforward and you'll like it and it's not too violent. It's good. So what would Julia say she believes are her strong suits to solve a case? If she were going to tell you, you know, about her chart, but what would she say are her strong suits?
How is she able
to do this?
I think she has a very analytical mind, and I also think she has amazing perceptions about people, which she probably uses in dealing with her clients. I mean, she's learned enough as an astrologer to be very watchful of body language or in voice inflections. She's very careful about that. So she's one of those people that's sort of like a sponge in the room, and she notices things that other people might not notice. And maybe she's just kind of a natural detective, but mostly it's her good heart that gets her into trouble.
Well, I have to bring this up because this reminds me of somebody else. I won't say who. Claire. Michael's mother.
Mm-hmm.
She Michael's mother, Julia's fiance,
Julia,
who called Julia's fiance, who wants her to bring back what she, her Michael's stuff, her husband's ex-husband's stuff, because he died, I think. And Michael's mother wants everything, so she's not nice and she's mean to Julia. Her phone call was, her calls were there, and the way she answered her was perfect. So how come you included her? I thought I could, you know. I won't tell you who she reminds me of, but yeah. It was like,
Maybe we all have somebody like that in our life or know somebody like that. It was just a chance for additional conflict for Julia. Julia's ex-fiancé, Michael, who was killed, was a really, really dear soul, and as is Michael's sister, Maggie, who Julia's close to. Maggie's younger than Julia. Celia, their mother, was probably never standing on solid ground, and with Michael's death, she just goes inward, and she's not a particularly warm or outgoing person, and she may have been one of those mothers that thought that no woman was good enough for her son. You know, we've all known people like that. So Julia is particularly sensitive in this regard because she was raised by her grandmother. She's basically an orphan. Her parents were killed when she was very young. And Julia really wants a family. She wants to belong and hopes that Michael's family will welcome her. But Celia, the mother, does not, of course, and was barely tolerating of Julia. And after Michael's death, Celia really is not doing well. She's made a shrine of Michael's room, and she obsesses constantly about Michael, Michael's life, Michael's things. And Julia and Michael were living together. They were planning their wedding. And when Julia moved into her current apartment, she, of course, had boxes with some of Michael's things in them that she just couldn't deal with after his death. And Celia's now got a bee in her bonnet that Julia's holding on to things that really should belong to Celia. So she tortures her a bit in this particular book. I'm wondering if maybe Celia's... Oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, she does. She does torture her. But, you know, she doesn't understand that Julia has a loss also. They both do.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And, of course, Julia gets angry at Celia, and then she feels kind of guilty because Julia lost her future, but Celia lost a child, which is terrible, and just like the Leary family. So Julia really struggles to have compassion for Celia.
Well, let's talk about the title. How did you come up with that title? And then we're going to get down to some final questions that should be very interesting, people. Keep your ears open.
Well, actually, the publisher came up with that title. I like it. I had originally planned to name each book after a planet. So the first book in this series, the first Zodiac mystery, is The Madness of Mercury. And I had planned to call this book Dark Sun. There's a reference to Dark Sun in the beginning of the book. My publisher, Midnight Inc., did not like that title, and they decided to call it All Signs Point to Murder. And as you know, I'm sure, you know, most authors don't have a choice over cover art or titles or anything of that sort. But All Signs Point to Murder was a catchy title, so I like that. The third book in this series I have turned in. It still has to go through the editing process. I've called it Tale of the Dragon, and I'm kind of hoping that my publisher keeps that. It's also an astrological reference, which you learn in the book. And then this, as I said, this particular book I had planned to call Dark Sun, and the third book I had planned to call Widow's Moon, but I like Tale of the Dragon better. So, it's kind of funny. You get very attached to a title when you're working on a book. Mm-hmm. It becomes second nature, so it's a little disorienting when the publisher wants to change the title, and you have to make sure that all references to the new title are correct. But that's how that particular title came about. When I wrote the Soup Lovers mysteries for Berkeley Prime Crime, they came up with the first title, which was A Spoonful of Murder, and then they took my choices for the following books. The second book in that series is A Broth of Betrayal, because, you know, they loved plays on words. And the third book is A Rue of Revenge. And they came up with the fourth title is Ladle to the Grave. And I think, I can't remember, but I think the fifth book in that series, they came up with that title, which is A Clue in the Stew. So a lot of people laugh at those titles, but all those culinary cozy books from Berkeley Prime Crime like to have plays on words. Like one other author, I think it's Casey Daniels, had a book called Chili Con Carnage. I'm not sure if she wrote that as Casey Daniels or Kylie Logan, but that was kind of a funny one, Chili Con Carnage.
No, so I got picked up by an independent publisher, which is almost like a real publisher. And A Daughter's Promise is the title I came up with. And then they asked me to come up with the cover art, which I did.
Oh, okay.
I did. I was surprised. Yeah, they said, we can ask you some suggestions. The cover is my mom, graduation picture from high school, because I didn't want her looking sick with Alzheimer's. And the frame, they asked me to look for something, and I found a 1940s frame that was perfect for the book. And the fact that she loved roses, there's a rose at the bottom. So at least I was given that much. What they did do, and I thought was fantastic, was that they added a preface, and they helped me to decide which research to add to the book and everything. And yeah, their edit prose is really good. And hopefully they do my next one. My next one is going to be, I'm going to rewrite one of my books. I just, as a matter of fact, I just ordered it so that I would have it in front of me so I could tear it up and write it and cut and paste. I'm going to do something based on hate for children, to understand that hate is a terrible word. And that everybody needs to get along. And as an educator dealing with kids that didn't always get along, I think it's important. And I think I'm just going to title it Everyone Counts. I think that title sounds great to me. If they don't like it, you'll let me know. But I think that we need to know, you know, how to deal with other people from other nations. So, next question. Julia goes back to Mako, and she gets stuck. How come she can't escape? Why? She's like a glutton for punishment here.
Yeah. Well, she gets locked in one of the storage rooms, or one of the larger kitchens in the back of the bar. She doesn't intend to snoop, but when she comes in, the restaurant is open. They serve lunches, and then they have a break, and then they serve dinner, and there's a floor show at night. She goes to the restaurant in hopes of finding Tony and talking to Tony about Moira. When she gets there, the place is open, but there are no patrons. They're basically closed until the dinner hour. And she goes in through an employee's door into a kitchen where there's ladies who don't speak English. They're Asian. She suspects they're not Chinese, perhaps Vietnamese, because where she grew up in North Beach, she hears Cantonese all the time. And she goes down the hallway and goes in. She hears people coming, and she zips into a storeroom. And she doesn't want to be caught snooping, so she climbs into one of those huge industrial cabinets as the door opens and some crates are delivered. And then she discovers that she's locked in behind a steel door, and she has no idea how she's going to get out, because other than climbing through an air conditioning duct, she can't think of any other way. But like The Perils of Pauline, she does find a way out and escapes without being seen.
She's
it's kind of fun to write those scenes.
When she was doing that. Yeah, I know. She was giving me claustrophobia, seriously. I was like, oh, my God, how's she going to get out? What can I say? So when she finally realizes what happens to Moira and learns about a whole bunch of blah, blah, I'm not going to read what I wrote, a whole bunch of things that she was doing, what is the reaction of the family when they learn everything that Moira was doing? And I'm not going to list it because I'm going to cross it out, because they can't tell these people everything.
Well, I think they're already devastated by Moira's death. And, of course, when the whole story comes out and they realize the extent of betrayal, I'm sure that, at the end of the book, Brooke goes on a sabbatical to recover. But I'm sure that Dan may feel justified because there's people he doesn't like in the family. But basically, when things like that happen in real life, it just puts your life on a different path. Nothing is ever the same again. You may heal.
That's true.
You may recover. And like Julia, in her life, she had planned on one sort of a life, and a death of a loved one for her sent her off in a totally different direction. If anybody had ever told her, you'll be a practicing astrologer, you won't be a teacher, and you won't be married, she wouldn't have chosen that path. It was chosen for her. And, you know, what is it, John Lennon? Life is what happens when you're making other plans.
Yeah. Well, before I forget, on Tuesday, the author of Dark Harvest will be here. That is really a book that's frightening and stem cell. On Monday night, I have to announce, because I'm like so excited, I can't believe it. 9 o'clock is late, people, but I'm going to do this. Dr. Maxine Thompson has invited me to be on August 1st at 9 o'clock, and I will be asked the questions, and if you think I know what they are, I don't. She doesn't tell me.
Oh, she's
just going to ask away, and people from all over the world ask the person that takes the phone, that calls me, the questions, and then he asks the questions for Maxine. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
It's a very expensive network, and they asked me to join it, and I just, you know, it's a lot of money, and I said, I'll stick with Blog Talk, and I do just fine this way. So on 9/6, my favorite person in the universe, who invites me to the Thriller Fest every year, John Land, will be here with Fabio Picardi from Las Vegas, and we're going to talk about Dark Dawn Light. And on the 12th, New York Times author E. Zwinski, The Binding, which you find out what the binding of a book is really made out of. You might be careful when you touch it. On the 13th, we're going to talk about colorblind, and that's about a teacher that was a black teacher in a white school that was ostracized and what happens to her. Book is fantastic. On the 26th, one of my favorite people, A Face to Die For, Andrea Kane. And on the 27th, I Know a Secret, none other than Tess Gerritsen, takes center stage. And if you're looking for something to read, pick up a couple of million copies of All Signs Point to Murder, because, you know, for Labor Day, kids get bored, you get bored, you're sitting on the beach and you may as well read. Seriously, it's beautiful outside. You might want to try to read Look Behind You by Iris Johansson, which is a phenomenal book. And finally, C.E. Tobesman, Proof. Okay, so when they learn about emails between her and Brooke, do they believe what she says?
They being the family?
Yeah, does anybody believe?
Yeah. Well, of course, the police do believe it. The family can't even conceive of that, because Brooke is a woman who's very fair-minded, very hardworking, loved Moira, always was getting Moira out of scrapes. And so they cannot possibly believe that Brooke would ever do anything that would lead to trouble for Moira or herself. She's a woman who was born with a Sun-Venus conjunction in Libra, which is just a lovely thing. And she's a very open, very fair-minded, very loving person. So, no, the family doesn't believe that could be the case.
I wonder what would happen if Julia decided to do her own chart, where it would lead her, and what she would find out.
Well, of course, if I talk to
you. Yeah, I'm wondering what you would write if you had to create Julia's chart. What month was she born in, anyway?
Oh, she was born in November. She's a very late Sagittarian. And I made her a Sagittarian because they're a fire sign, and they are outgoing. There's rare instances when they're not, but they're outgoing, they're optimistic, they're generous. I think it's a wonderful fire sign. And they can also be a little bit reckless, as Julia is. So I wanted Julia to be the kind of person to, not that she's not kind of person, well, maybe she does leap before she looks, but she tries to keep it within bounds, and she has a knack of getting herself out of trouble when she's into it. But I haven't talked too much about Julia's chart because I don't want to box myself in. And but do you know what I mean? If I need to change things later. But one of the things I've become aware of is that I have to be very careful about what I say about astrology and really make sure I have a real chart for my murderer, a real chart for my victim, or any chart that I talk about, because my publisher has been wonderful about getting reviews. And the first book, Madness of Mercury, was reviewed by Del Horoscope and by the Mountain Astrologer in Colorado. And astrologers really, really pay attention to this. And so I have to be very careful not to make any mistakes and make sure that, you know, I have the facts straight, because they'll pick up on it in an instant. In fact, one of the reviewers said that Julia talks about a client's ascendant when the client didn't have a birth time, which wasn't quite accurate. It's just that I didn't mention in the book that the client had a birth time. So that's the kind of thing that would go over most people's heads. They couldn't care less about astrology, but it's something that astrologers really do look at. So I really try to be accurate.
Well, I know, I would imagine, because you don't want to get caught giving, you know, wrong information or something like that. Yeah, mm-hmm. And astrology is not anything that's easy. So being accurate does matter with everything. That's why I'm doing that show on the 9th with all these people, because so many people present things to the courts or the forensics that I know right away after reading so many that crime scenes, you need to be careful not to corrupt them. And in one particular book, I think it was only one time that I was reviewing something for a different company, for a publicist, but I said, I can't review this book because the crime scene makes no sense. The guy was a retired chief of police, and the regular chief of police said that he can't handle the case. He called this guy in out of nowhere, and his wife was in the grave giving him the bones. I said, I don't think so. And I was just like, oh, my God. Yeah, I refused to review. That was the only time I ever did not. I didn't even read the whole book. I just gave it away. The ending is a total surprise and leads readers to believe that the Leary family is going to change. So in your next book, are you bringing them back again, or is this going to be a whole other thing?
No, the Leary family, Julia may have contact with her friend Geneva, but this book was about that family and that particular crime. In the next book that's coming up, I like to make everyone different. In the next book that's coming up, a former client, or a current client, I should say, and friend of Julia, has a lot of trouble in his business, and he asks Julia to come back to work for him for just a few days to try to gather information and find out who's causing the problems. And so each book will have a totally different crime. They can all be read as standalones. There's no problem there. But it does track Julia's life and Julia's relationships. That's the one solid through line. But every single book will be a different set of circumstances, a different crime. The main characters in this series are Julia and her two good friends, her grandmother that she's very close to, and her grandmother's friend, Quan, the Chinese man who lives in her grandmother's first floor apartment, who practices acupuncture and Chinese medicine. And Julia, they're all very close, and Julia thinks of him almost as her grandfather, her surrogate grandfather. And I'm planning on another story that will involve Quan and the history of Julia's deceased grandfather, and why Quan is so close to her grandmother and her deceased grandfather, because there's a lot of very, very interesting history about the Chinese in San Francisco, particularly
after that makes it really interesting.
Yeah. Historical research is so interesting. And after the 1906 earthquake, there was a lot of prejudice towards the Chinese, and the business people and politicians wanted to do a land grab of the area that is currently present-day Chinatown. And there was a plot to build a Chinatown at Hunter's Point, which is down in the South Bay. Hunter's Point has been, since the 50s, some projects and not a great area. But the plan was to move the Chinese to Hunter's Point and create this other quote-unquote Chinatown. And if you've ever been to San Francisco and seen Chinatown, it's terrific. It's wonderful. It really has a lot of shops and a lot of atmosphere. And it was only because, actually, one of the reasons that the Chinese were able to stay in Chinatown and hang on to that land was because Theodore Roosevelt was hosting the Empress of China, who came for a visit because he wanted to maintain his connection with Chinese power, because he knew that we would be ultimately in a war with Japan. So it was her influence that actually helped to keep Chinatown where it is today.
Chinatown is really an experience. I was there last year. It really is. It's an experience, and everybody should really just go there. But when my sister was alive, we used to walk from the bus to Canal Street, which is like 100 blocks. I mean, I made everybody walk, seriously. And then to Chinatown, and then by the time we got back to the bus to come back home, you had enough exercise to last you for a year. But it was fun.
Yeah.
So one final question. Where can people learn more about you and your work?
Well, they can go to my website, which is Connie DeMarco with a D-I, ConnieDeMarco.com. You can read my blogs. You can go to Amazon, my author page, and learn more about me there. My other series is the Soup Lovers Mysteries from Berkeley Prime Crime, and I have a different website for that series. That series was written as Connie Archer, and if you go to ConnieArcherMysteries.com, you can learn about that series. And there's a button on my main website, Connie DeMarco, that will take you to my other mysteries. So either way, you know, they cross-pollinate. And that's about it. I'm always blogging. I'm just finishing up a blog tour with Partners in Crime. And you can find me on Facebook as well and Twitter. My Twitter handle for this Zodiac Mysteries is at AskZodia. Zodia is the column, the advice column that Julia writes for the San Francisco Chronicle. And she answers questions from people who write in to the newspaper. And her column is called Ask Zodia. So I thought that was kind of a fun Twitter handle for this series to have.
That's interesting. Maybe you should incorporate asking the questions in one of your novels for murder. That might be cool. You just never know.
Right.
Well, thank you so very much. I'm going to post your review as soon as I make sure that it's perfect, because I hear my mother's voice in my head telling me it better not have any, you know, errors or anything like that. And I hope you do another blog tour with Partners in Crime so I get to read
the next book. Oh,
they're
terrific.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, friend.
You're so very, very welcome. Everybody have a nice day. And it's beautiful outside, but if you're bored and you have nothing better to do, which is nothing better to do, pick up a book and read. Everybody have a nice day, and bye.